Let's imagine something together. Let's imagine that we're traveling across the country with our family in the back of the car, the kids, everybody, maybe an aunt or an uncle, and it's summertime and it's hot. Maybe we're traveling through the rural South and somebody needs to go to the bathroom and somebody else is thirsty and somebody else is hungry and we're looking for a place to stop, but we can't find any place. You see, let's imagine, if we need to, that we're black and that this is Jim Crow era and that most places won't serve us. What are we going to do about that? Well, if we're lucky, we have a particular resource. It's called the Negro Motorist Green Book, and it'll tell us who will actually accept us on our travels. It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. Today with me, Alfred Brophy of the University of North Carolina, and he's going to tell us all about this relic of the Jim Crow South.
This is your Weekly Constitutional, underwritten by James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in Grundy, Virginia.
Recently, I read about some research that had been done by Alfred Brophy. He's a professor of law at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And it was on a subject that I had only become familiar with in recent years. It was about something called the Green Book, or more properly, the Negro Motorist Green Book. And this is something probably most white folks have never heard of, and perhaps not even black folks today. It was a workaround, Jim Crow. It was a way for a black family, or any black travelers, who were traveling through the segregated South or other parts of the country that might be segregated, a way for them to find the things that every traveler needs, a place to stop to go to the bathroom, a place to stop to buy a meal in a restaurant, a place to stop for a drink of water. All of these things were difficult when many of so-called public accommodations were closed to African Americans. Now, it's a sad fact that the book was necessary, but it was, given the existence of Jim Crow, quite a lifesaver for quite a lot of people. Alfred Brophy found out about this, as I did, through his research, and he followed it up. And he actually is going to tell us all about the Green Book and how it exemplifies the economic division of this country under Jim Crow.
My name's Al Brophy, and I teach law at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. And a lot of what I teach about is property and trusts and estates, and I'm particularly interested in African-American legal history and how a sort of legacy of discrimination against African-Americans in housing and in other areas of life continues to affect home ownership and patterns of segregation today.
Well, that's a fascinating take on all of this because I'm very accustomed to talking to other constitutional law professors or maybe people who say they're civil liberties professor, but you are a property guy.
It's an unusual combination, isn't it?
Can I ask you to make me one promise?
Sure.
We're not going to ask any question on future interests, are we?
No.
Okay.
No, we're good. This will be, fairly straightforward stuff.
Uh-huh.
So I'm interested in how, over time, there were patterns of segregation. Sometimes those patterns of segregation arose just because, naturally, people congregate of the same race congregated in particular neighborhoods. But in many instances, that was the result of conscious decisions by homeowners who had contracts among themselves to not sell houses to people of African descent or Asian descent, and sometimes there were religious restrictions also. And those blanketed much of the desirable housing stock in this country from the 1920s through the late 1940s when the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the enforcement of racially restrictive covenants.
Wow. And, you know, I sometimes tell my law students that property law might seem dull to them, zoning law might seem dull to them, but there are huge constitutional issues here and large things at stake. So this is wonderful. I want to hear all about this. So please tell me more.
Well thanks. So we have these racially restrictive covenants that had been put on much of the desirable housing stock. And in the wake of leading into World War II, but certainly in the wake of World War II, there were challenges as the African-American population became more affluent and much more assertive in asking for their equal rights. And so there were challenges in many cities across the United States to these racially restrictive covenants. Goes up in 1948, the U.S. Supreme Court strikes them down. The famous case is called Shelley against Kramer. There's also a companion case that struck down restrictive covenants in Washington, D.C. And then in the wake of those, African-Americans, other religious and racial minorities had the legal right to purchase and occupy that property. Although in many instances, even though the covenants were no longer legally enforceable, they still had a shadow effect where people would, you know, communities would refuse to, sellers would refuse to sell property. And this is also a whole process of African-Americans moving into upgrading their housing stock in the 1950s, really. And then this is the moment where, as African-Americans move into the more desirable neighborhoods, then you begin to have, you know, what we talk about as white flight. Affluent white homeowners then begin to flee to the suburbs. So you've got this sort of back and forth about how housing stock in our large cities was segregated, and then it begins to flip, and then it's segregated again. And though these covenants have not been enforceable for decades, there continues to be large housing segregation.
So, yeah, this is a huge issue, and I have a little bit of personal experience that I'll share. I was actually born in Detroit, and as I'm sure you know, that's among the most racially segregated cities in the United States. And I recall vividly descriptions of redlining, which is when real estate agents would simply draw lines on maps, and they would not sell to black families in certain areas. And when they did, this was sometimes referred to as something called block busting. And then when a block was busted by the presence of an African-American family, then, as you describe, white flight would occur.
It's a really interesting process that goes on exactly as you've described it. And, you know, so there was pressure among white families not to sell out. But then there's also the sense that, well, once African-Americans started to move onto the block, the housing values would decline. So there were, you know, this is part of the block busting, right, is the process of somebody says, well, the real estate agent comes and you got to sell now while your housing values are still higher than they will be once the neighborhood becomes integrated, once the block becomes integrated. So there's many stories and many perspectives on how to look at this. It was an opportunity for African-Americans to upgrade housing stock and to live closer to work and in better homes. And it was a great opportunity for them, though the flip side of this is, you know, the housing segregation continued as white families moved out to the suburbs. And now what we're seeing is this reverse flight, and you've got gentrification in many cities. So now the housing stock is becoming more valuable, and African Americans are often being pushed out further out of the city as more affluent folks want to come back to the city and have housing stock again that's close to where they work.
Well, I don't think you're ever going to run out of issues to think about and write about. I will add one other aspect of this that I happen to have personal knowledge of. Other members of my family own property in the South in a wonderfully named development called Fellowship Park, and a very nice area, very happy to have it. And one day I pulled out the deeds and I realized that the fellowship in question was a retirement community planned in the 1920s by our friends in the Ku Klux Klan.
Wow, and that's really, really interesting.
It was, and it was doubly interesting when I read that my own property was subject to those very sorts of restrictive covenants that you have described, telling me that I could not sell to African-American families or anybody, basically, except white people.
It's a really interesting story. Let me just break in here with two or three vignettes, right?
Sure.
That's true of almost all of the desirable housing stock in major cities in the United States that were constructed from about 1915 till about 1940. I mean, these things are, they blanket the desirable housing stock in many, many cities. And that, I think, is what was so powerful because they are so prevalent. That's what made it easier for the NAACP when they challenged these restrictive covenants in the Supreme Court immediately after World War II, to say that it would be unconstitutional to enforce these because essentially you're making most of the desirable housing stock unavailable to people on the basis of race. And not to get too technical about this, but usually when we're thinking about constitutional rights, those are rights that are only protected against the government. They don't protect against private discrimination. We'll talk in a little bit about some federal statutes that prohibit private discrimination, but those weren't in existence in 1948. And the Supreme Court took this sort of bold step and said, to the extent that you're trying to enforce these private covenants in the courts, that implicates government action. And I think they said this precisely because it was basically prohibiting African Americans from purchasing huge swaths of the desirable property.
Right. I'm glad you mentioned that, Al. And you're right. It is a very technical issue from most people's perspective. But this is a show about the Constitution. So from time to time, we have to get down in the weeds. And let me just restate what you've said. By and large, before anybody can assert a constitutional right, that person has to be able to point to a government action, because the Constitution only protects us against the government. But here you have private restrictive covenants. But in a very rare departure from the general doctrine, the court here said, well, even though it's not the government that's directly discriminating against African Americans, it's really private parties discriminating against them, the government is enough involved, especially through the intervention of the enforcement mechanism in the judiciary, to make this that rare case where we're going to find that there's government action, even though really, fundamentally, it's private discrimination. This is Shelley versus Kramer is an extremely important case in that regard.
Exactly right. Critically important, and I defer to your expertise on this, but it seems to me as though it's one of the outer reaches of sort of Supreme Court jurisprudence as it relates to race. It's sort of one of the furthest the court, I think, has gone. Let me footnote this with one other thing. You may have seen the Washington Post recently ran an article in response to all the talk about that movie Selma and the sort of criticism that it portrays LBJ on an unfair light, because he was actually a strong supporter of civil rights. Mm-hmm. And signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, the Fair Housing Act of 1968. And they went back and discovered that he had purchased a house with Labor Johnson in 1961 that had, you know, this racially restrictive covenant on it. Of course, the covenant was unenforceable by 1961, but the Johnsons filed an affidavit that said, in essence, we know we're purchasing this property, but we disagree with this covenant, and we're putting everybody on notice that we think this is unenforceable legally and morally, and we'll sell the property to whomever we want.
Very interesting.
Yeah, really, really interesting how this creeps up in all sorts of different ways.
I have not seen the movie you referenced there, but I'm aware of the criticisms, and I'm very interested in following up on that at some point, because my understanding has been that Lyndon Johnson was a very strong civil rights president. Not a perfect one, and he's not a perfect human being by any stretch of the imagination, but I'll be watching that movie with close attention, because I'm sensitive to that criticism. I think LBJ should be treated as the second greatest civil rights president in our history.
I agree with you. It hasn't yet opened in Chapel Hill, but I'm looking forward to watching it, and I'm very excited to see the movie, although I'm always sad when there are movies that purport to be about history that then, you know, re-spin and get the story sort of inaccurate. And the sad part about this is LBJ took a lot of punishment for having stood up for civil rights.
Yes, he did.
Now, you know, Hollywood is portraying him as the bad guy rather than a person who was ahead of the curve. But that's a story maybe for another conversation.
We're just touching upon all kinds of fascinating things. It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with law professor Alfred Brophy of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, all about a topic that may be completely unfamiliar to you. It's something called the Negro Motorist Green Book. After the break, we will continue our conversation with Alfred Brophy right after we have our constitutional quiz. So stay tuned.
Lord, I wonder when I'll hear good news. Oh, Lord, I wonder when I'll hear good news. Right now I'm gonna tell you I've got them bad housing blues.
Well, quiz fans, it's that time again, and coming to the mound is our pitcher, our quiz guy, Doug Smith. How are you, Doug?
I'm doing great. I'm stretching a little bit, getting ready to pitch it out.
Tremendous. Well, you know, old people do need to do their stretching.
Yeah, you know, the older I get, the more stretching I need to do, and yet I can do less and less of it.
It's one of those anomalies of age, isn't it?
It is.
One of those paradoxes. Yes. And yes. Well, we could go on and on about that, but actually I want to hear about your quiz. Do you have a quiz for us today?
I do. I've got a quiz today, and it's about Daniel Webster.
Daniel Webster. Well, he's an old guy. In fact, he's so old that he's dead, isn't he?
Yeah, he's one of them.
Okay. He's one of these old dead white guys. Okay. But very prominent in our history, so that sounds like a good topic. Do we have anybody on the line?
Yes.
Well, who are you?
I am Kelsey.
Kelsey. Where are you from, Kelsey?
Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I spent the summer of 1985 in Pittsburgh working for a great big law firm there downtown, living in Shadyside, riding in and out of the East Busway. It is a fabulous city.
In 93, I was in just south of Pittsburgh.
Really?
I really was. In Uniontown.
Uniontown.
I was rebuilding houses south of Pittsburgh with the Appalachian Service Project or something.
Okay, so in just a very brief statement there, Doug, you've managed to emphasize two things. One, that you're younger than I am.
Yeah, you will.
And two, that you are far, far more motivated by good deeds than I was because, of course, I was just there making tons of money.
Yeah, I made nothing.
Okay, well, okay, I guess you're just a better person than I. Okay, Kelsey, I really want you to kick Doug's butt today. So, Doug, give her your quiz.
All right, Kelsey, are you ready? I'm going to give you a question and give you four options.
Daniel
Webster of Massachusetts was referred to as what? A, author of the dictionary. B, builder of bridges. C, master of the Constitution. Or D, expounder of the Constitution. I'm going to go through those again. A, author of the dictionary. B, builder of bridges. C, master of the Constitution. Or D, expounder of the Constitution.
Kelsey, I'm not going to be able to help you on this one.
Daniel Webster.
Daniel Webster. While I want to say he's the dictionary guy, I feel like that's probably wrong. So I'll go with D.
With which one?
D.
D or B?
D as in dog.
D as in dog.
Why did you just skip immediately from A, which was the dictionary thing, all the way down to the bottom?
That just seemed like the most correct answer there.
Well, why not
founder of the Constitution?
Why not C, the what was the other C? Master of the Constitution? That's kind of similar, isn't it?
It is a little bit similar, but I don't think that he was any sort of Supreme Court justice or anything like that where he would be a master of it, so
I don't know. Maybe
I could
he was,
be wrong.
Maybe
though.
He was a slave owner. I mean, maybe that's the reference. I don't know. What about
from Massachusetts?
From okay. What about the builder? What about this bridge? B.
Maybe he was a wonderful civil engineer, but unless my memory is incorrect, I know he was a senator. So.
Oh, Kelsey, don't let him run you astray. You have got this exactly right. Senator Daniel Webster.
You stuck to your guns,
Massachusetts.
Kelsey.
Massachusetts. He was called the expounder of the Constitution, largely because he was an orator.
Right.
He was a brilliant orator. Wasn't the dictionary dude. That was Noah.
Yeah,
Webster.
I thought you might go for that. Good for you, though.
But, you know, Webster's a curious guy in American history because during the War of 1812, first of all, he is of the third generation. He's not of the colonial generation of leaders, you know, that kind of leads up to Jefferson.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not of the constitutional era, which is really the Madison, but he's really that third generation. These are the guys that come in after the Constitution is set, and they're really pushing on powers clauses, whether it's executive, judicial, or legislative. And he actually goes toe-to-toe with Madison on the War of 1812, in no way supports that.
Really?
Yeah, but there's a little-known story about Webster that's fascinating with regard to Madison. After Madison, of course, Madison owns slaves. After Madison dies, James and Dolly, neither one of them free the slaves. But one of their slaves, who was actually the personal valet of James Madison, President James Madison, Paul Jennings, arranged to buy his own freedom. And he did that. He bought his freedom, settled in Washington, D.C., and really is this amazing American success story about building his family, getting these great jobs, largely because he had networked for so long. He had been in the room with James Madison for all those years, highly literate, got a job in government, was very, very successful in his own right. The person who helped him to buy his freedom, Daniel Webster.
Good for you, Daniel.
Daniel Webster.
And good for you, Paul Jennings. In fact, we talked a lot about Paul on the show. He wrote that very, very good book. Basically his memoirs.
That's right. It was the first White House memoir.
Right, exactly.
By a slave. Remarkable. A freed slave. And good on Beth Taylor.
Beth Taylor, yes.
Who wrote A Slave in the White House. She really has brought Paul Jennings to light and reminds us this story where he essentially bought his freedom with the help of Daniel Webster.
Thank you very much for that exposition, Doug. And I'm just still absolutely stunned that you did so well on this quiz. So give us an email at ywc@montpelier.org and give us your t-shirt size and your snail mail address, and we will have one in the mail to you along with your pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier.
Wonderful.
Okay. Thanks for playing, and thanks to you, Doug.
Thanks, Stuart. Hey, it's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to continue our discussion with Al Brophy, who's a professor of law at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, all about something called the Negro Motorist Green Book. We've been talking about housing discrimination. We've been talking about restrictive covenants, the special constitutional problems that they create. But, you know, the interesting thing is, Al, I don't think that's what we were supposed to be talking about.
It's funny how all of the stuff race relates to everything, right?
It sure does.
And public accommodations as well.
It certainly does. Well, let's talk about that. We're actually going to be segueing into a discussion of something that you know a lot about called the Green Book. Why don't you tell us what that is and how it relates to what we've been talking about?
Yeah, really interesting story. So there's this, it has various names over time. It's first started published in the 1930s, and it goes up in one form or another. I think they're still publishing it in the mid-60s after the Civil Rights Act of 1964 has outlawed discrimination in public accommodations. But it was a tour guide for African Americans, so that when they would, you know, some of your older listeners may remember the AAA guides that would sort of, you know, give you advice on where to stay and where to eat and maybe some other tourist sites. And this was very similar to that. It's designed just for African Americans so that when they're going on long trips, they would know where they could stay, because so many of the restaurants and certainly hotels and motels in our country were unavailable to African Americans, certainly in the 30s and 40s, and then begins to break down in the 1950s. And the final kick to that, the final bookend to that, is the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
Let's put this in a wider context, and just I'm sure most people who listen are familiar with this, but let's just make it straight. Civil War. After the Civil War, no more slavery, 13th Amendment, 14th Amendment, 15th Amendment have to do with citizenship, voting rights, et cetera. A brief period during Reconstruction where there are actually some civil rights acts that do have some positive effect on helping to establish equality. Then a long period in the late 19th century, early 20th century, often called the low point or the nadir of race relations, when we see the neo-Confederates coming back into power in the South after Reconstruction. We see the passage of what they called Black Codes, which came to be commonly known as Jim Crow. And among the many restrictions during the Jim Crow era, which, as you say, stretched right up into the 1960s, were restrictions in something called public accommodations. And that's just restaurants, hotels, other businesses, places where the public goes. But in most cases, those public accommodations were privately owned. And there was a huge constitutional issue that was decided against the Civil Rights Acts of the 1800s that said that the 14th Amendment did not give Congress the power to regulate privately owned public accommodations. And so that's the constitutional reason that the Jim Crow era was allowed to persist during all of this time. And so what you're describing is a workaround. You're talking about African Americans who could not stop to go to the bathroom, could not stop to buy a drink or to buy a meal at most places. This was their guide so that they could make a trip across the segregated South and actually find some place to sleep and some place to eat.
Exactly. And let me just sort of connect this up to the earlier discussion when we were talking about that famous 1948 case in the U.S. Supreme Court, Shelley v. Kramer, that said, okay, we're going to construe this private discrimination, these private covenants, as essentially state action. And that links up to this 14th Amendment, right, argument that you were saying that in the 19th century, that's when the Supreme Court struck down Congress's statutes that made it a crime to deprive somebody of their civil rights and, I guess, allowed for some civil penalties as well. And so, you know, as you pointed out, there was this very brief period known as Reconstruction that runs from the end of the Civil War in 1865 to about 1877 and earlier in a few places, where there was federal enforcement of civil rights in the South. And then in the wake of Reconstruction...
And before you go on, and during that period, we had federal civil rights statutes that were being enforced. And they parallel to a great extent what was later passed in the 1960s. People don't realize that. There was a real attempt by Congress during Reconstruction to really enforce civil rights.
Yeah, a very interesting story, right? So we've got these Civil Rights Act of 1866 and 1871 passed that for a brief moment protected both the civil and African Americans against civil and criminal discrimination. And then the Supreme Court sort of shuts the door on that. And then, as you say, in the 1960s, two things happen. One, Congress comes back to this and repasses very similar statutes. And the other thing is the U.S. Supreme Court goes back and says, well, maybe we were construing those acts a little too narrowly. So, you know, a lot of the suits that now take place against the government for discrimination on civil rights are based on either the 1866 or the 1871 Civil Rights Act.
It's absolutely astonishing. It really is. And what the Supreme Court has done is that it's, and in fact Congress did, they don't base these civil rights laws anymore upon the 14th Amendment. They base them upon, of all things, the Commerce Clause.
Right.
And the commerce power, which seems extraordinarily inappropriate until you think about it for just a moment. All of these things involve commerce. They involve...
I'm sorry for cutting up with it. So this Green Book, the Negro Motorist Green Book, illustrates the way in which particularly public accommodations affect interstate commerce, right? It's designed largely for people who are traveling across states, so they'll know where they can stop and, as you say, use the facilities or get something to eat or spend the night.
Now that we've set up the context and now people understand why there was a need for a Green Book, who did this? Who published this thing? How did it get to be called the Green Book?
Yeah, so there was a guy, and his name was, I think, Vincent Green, who first started it, and I guess he, you know, first aimed it I think he's based in Harlem. He first aimed it at sort of New York, and then it began to be something people liked, and so he began to expand it nationwide. And, you know, it served a bunch of different purposes, right? One is it's a guidebook. But he was also doing this to make some money, and he sold advertisements. Esso, which is the forerunner of Exxon, which often was happy to sell their stations. They had some African-American owned franchises, and they were happy to sell to African-Americans, to provide services to African-Americans, advertised in this. And you had hotels and often restaurants, beauty parlors would also advertise in this. So it was a money-making proposition that was designed to fill a need that had arisen because African-American motorists, when they're traveling outside of their home area, wouldn't know where to stop. One of the things your listeners might like to do is actually take a look at the book, and if you sort of Google it, you can find a copy. The PDF file is enormous, so it's going to take a while to download, but if you find a copy, the University of Michigan has it on their website. And it's really interesting to just sort of go through and, you know, look at various towns and then sort sort of match that up to see if he can still find those buildings. A lot of them, of course, have been taken down as part of urban renewal, and a lot of them have fallen under the wrecking ball as the interstate system was built. But every once in a while, you can still find a place that survives. And I was down in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, not too long ago, and I went by to take a look at a very modest home. It's now a private residence where African Americans could stop there.
That was actually my understanding, is that a lot of these things were private homes that might simply have a room to let, or they would be a sort of a boarding house situation. So they, I mean, these were not always actual traditional public accommodations where the African Americans could go.
You're exactly right. I mean, there were a lot of people who were trying to make a little bit of extra money by taking in travelers. And so a lot of them literally are private homes. And in one of the editions of the book, it says something like, you know, always be respectful when you're, you know, approaching one of these motor homes, that we have as much up-to-date information as possible, but sometimes people, you know, no longer are operating their boarding home. So it's sort of interesting, right, in the pre-internet era, how the publishers of the Green Book tried to have as much up-to-date information as possible, but didn't always.
Well, that was going to be my next question to you, is how did they get their information? Did they just drive around and...
Well, actually, what they do is they solicited businesses to contact them and tell them that they were available. And so they have an invitation in the front of the book to ask people to... submit their information, what services they provide, restaurants, motorhome, a lot of beauty parlors, interesting, and there's some music halls. It's just sort of anybody could who had operated a business that would accept African Americans could write in, and then the publishers of the book also would then try to sell advertising. So it sort of goes both ways.
Right. I'm just guessing that if the publishers were actually sending people out, that this was a fairly dangerous thing to be doing, to drive into a town in Mississippi, for example, as a black person, and to just start asking around, you know, where can I go? You might make a mistake and you might end up on the wrong side of a very unpleasant situation.
I could imagine that would certainly be the case, and I think it illustrates why the book had some purchase power.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it also, you know, you're getting at some of the hidden social mores. I think a lot of folks would, African-Americans traveling, would ask another African-American person that they saw in the city rather than trying to cross the sort of the color line. One of the neat stories about this is this book, though really fascinating to read, and important in and of itself, is just an illustration of the system of Jim Crow and how Jim Crow operated, how it created sort of parallel lives and parallel economies. So where, you know, there are tourist books for white people about where to live, there's also this tourist book for African-American people about where to stop and where to eat. It's far from complete. There, we know of a great many places that, particularly gas stations, that don't appear in here, but it's one sort of guidebook. And then, of course, it illustrates the sort of community knowledge that was built up in the African-American community about where to stop. So you can ask friends where they've stopped, or to think some of this gets distributed through, knowledge gets distributed through church and family networks. I was just out driving old Route 66 a few months ago. A dream of mine to do that. I was driving along Oklahoma, and there's a little tiny gas station there. It's not in operation anymore, but it was known as a filling station. And this was something that people, it was owned by an African-American man, and people in the African-American community knew that this was a place they could stop. And it's now on the National Register of Historic Places. It's really cool the way in which you've got this important history that is difficult to sort of recover. We only see little tiny pieces of it. The reason it's important to talk about this book is because it helps illustrate the parallel economy that existed for African Americans and for white people. So you have these segregated African American communities. They have their separate hotels, restaurants.
Yes, and it's a world that was almost invisible to most white people. I did not learn of the Green Book until, I believe, It was when I was reading Robert Caro's absolutely wonderful multi-volume biography of Lyndon Johnson. It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Professor Alfred Brophy of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, all about a strange and somewhat dated publication, but very historically significant, called The Negro Motorist Green Book. After the break, we will have our Madison Minute, and then we'll finish our discussion with Al Brophy, so stick around.
I've been traveling from toe to toe. Everywhere I have been, I find some old Jim Crow. One thing, people, I want everybody to know. You're gonna find some Jim Crow every place you go.
Madison's concern for a stronger union impinged on almost every issue he faced. He was delighted, for example, when in May 1784, Patrick Henry offered resolves in the Virginia legislature that money due to the Confederation be based on population rather than land valuation, and that unpaid requisitions be forcibly collected by, quote, distress on the property of the defaulting states or of their citizens. Madison observed pointedly the next year that, quote, a single frigate under the orders of Congress could make it the interest of any one of the Atlantic states to pay its just quota. Confederacy-wide measures and the power to compel obedience were also necessary to prevent ultimately self-defeating commercial disputes among the states. Moreover, foreign humiliation often resulted from the opportunity other nations had to intrigue and play one state against another. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
Fill her up.
Yes, sir.
You boys heading out?
Chicago.
Chicago, huh? You boys get around.
Yeah, we sure do.
Hey. Hey, you, where are you going?
The toilet.
Hell, come on, boy. You know you can't go in there. Cokes or nickel.
Take that hose out of the tank.
Robinson.
What?
He said take it out. We'll get our 99 gallons of gas someplace else.
All right, then. Gone. Gone! Use it.
That was a scene from the movie 42, in which Jackie Robinson visited a southern filling station and figured out how to actually get into the toilet. And apparently that scene was based on a real incident. You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to finish up our discussion with Alfred Brophy, who's a professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Alfred and I have been talking about something called the Negro Motorist Green Book, which was a travel guide that helped African Americans get across the Jim Crow South. And we were just at the point where we were talking about how President Lyndon Johnson, I think he was actually in the Senate at the time, how Senator Lyndon Johnson found out about the travails faced by African Americans as they traveled across the Jim Crow South. If memory serves, and it's been a number of years since I read this particular volume, if memory serves, it was the 1950s, and Lyndon Johnson had an African American couple that worked for him, and he would typically commute back and forth seasonally between Washington, D.C. and his home in Texas. And he gave this couple what he thought was a relatively pleasant task of transporting his Cadillac back and forth between D.C. and Texas, only belatedly realizing that he was sending them through an area where, for the most part, they could not stop. And it was this realization of this trial that he'd inadvertently put them through that helped to inform the sympathy that he felt for them.
That's a great story. It's always important to recall how personal experience and the, you know, stories of personal experience of people you know and respect can change your perspective or open your eyes.
Yeah.
The book itself sold, you know, in the low tens of thousands of copies, so it's far from in the hands of every African-American traveler. But I think it illustrates well the principle that you have to be careful where you try and stop for the night or eat. It drives home the power and the extent of the Jim Crow system. And, you know, there's sort of, you can think about this in the housing segregation in the 1910s and 1920s made it possible that when there was, racial violence, that the African-American community would often be particularly subject to it. You know, that when there were the terrible riots around World War I, in which the African-American communities were often destroyed, or in smaller towns, African-Americans were run out of town. And that was made possible because they were concentrated through, you know, these racially restrictive covenants and then norms of segregation in one particular part of the community. And that's just sort of a more dramatic illustration of this sort of phenomenon of Jim Crow, of segregation.
How did you learn about the Green Book? How did you get interested in it?
You know, it's interesting. One of my co-authors on a property book called Integrating Spaces, which is about sort of property law and race, both contemporary and historical, Alberto Lopez is the person who sort of turned me on to this. And then it's become something I've been very interested in, is sort of trying to go back and see the particular places that are described in the book. And I enjoy taking photographs of old buildings, and I try to go back and sort of see, and you know, what life was like through that. And it's a really cool project. There's another website that allows you to sort of look at a map of the United States, and they map a whole bunch of places in the Green Book. And so then you can sort of click on them. It's sort of neat to think about, hey, here's a building that's been there for decades, and it was once a haven for people who were not welcome elsewhere. Uh-huh. And so, you know, I encourage listeners, I think, would have a fun time just sort of, you know, paging through the PDFs of the book and looking at, you know, see if any towns in their state are listed there, and then what were those places?
Mm-hmm. It's a sad history, but of course it is very, very, it's fascinating to think about that. And I guess one could think of it in a positive way. These, as you say, are havens. These were the places people could go.
So if we could fast forward, one of the things I've been suggesting is the book, I think, is illustrative of the problems that this Jim Crow segregation set up. And a lot of it is by statute, but a lot of it is not by statute. It's just businesses, restaurants, certainly hotels, motels that catered to white people often would not serve African Americans. The famous Howard Johnson chain, I don't know if that still exists, but I know it was very popular when I was growing up.
I think it does. You're right. It used to be a lot more popular.
They had a bunch of restaurants in Virginia, and through the 1950s, they wouldn't serve African Americans. There's a very famous case of an African-American man. He worked for the IRS, who came over, I guess, from D.C. over to Arlington and, you know, wanted lunch or dinner there, and they wouldn't serve him, so he sued them, and he lost, and that's 1959. So you have this sort of system that continued until fairly recently, some businesses discriminating on their own, just deciding we're not going to serve African-Americans, and maybe they say we're not going to serve them because our white customers don't want that. There are all sorts of ways of thinking about the interplay between these businesses and their customers.
The name Green Book always suggested commerce to me. Now, you've just enlightened me that it was actually named after its original publisher. But the interplay between commerce on the one side and race on the other is a really interesting one that cuts both ways. It's quite possible to imagine, and I'm not defending any practices, I'm simply saying it's quite possible to imagine a fellow who's not at all racist, but who has a business that has a completely white clientele and who makes a rational decision that if I allow black people to come here, all my white customers will leave, and therefore I cannot let black people in my restaurant.
I mean, I think that's exactly the rationale that went through the minds of many businesses. And that was an argument that was raised. So fast forward just a few years to the debate over the Civil Rights Act, of what became the Civil Rights Act of 1960.
Mm-hmm.
And that act ultimately says, basically, if you're involved in public accommodations, so you're a restaurant or
hotels, motels, anything,
that you can't discriminate on the basis of race. You have to take all comers. And, you know, so you had the sort of the sit-ins, the Woolworth sit-ins, all these sorts of things that were building up to this in 1963, and then the acts passed in 64.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, you know, it was a really, I think, fulcrum moment in for property rights and in race. And a lot of people, a lot of businesses argue that, you know, we will lose our white customers if we have to be open across the board on race.
And in a short-term, local sense, many of them had an argument that might have destroyed some local businesses, or it might have cost the business owners some money. Now, of course, the counter-argument, beyond simply the simple justice and equality argument, the counter-argument is that over time, and in a macro sense, everybody's money is green. And so if you can abolish this sort of discrimination, then you will actually help the economy in the long run.
I mean, and that's certainly the argument that the proponents of the act put forward, right? They say we're in the middle of the 20th century. We're in the past World War II. This sort of distinction based on race, that's what the Nazis did. And, you know, what we want to do now is have it possible for African-Americans to drive across the country and, you know, not have to take empty jars and extra toilet paper.
That puts it in pretty stark terms, but that's exactly what you needed, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was possible to pass it because I think the moral case was so clear. They had people talking about the sacrifices of African-American soldiers during World War II, all sorts of appeals to basic equal treatment. And I think that's what made the act possible. And then after that, you know, you get sort of a whole series of things, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and then the Fair Housing Act of 1968, which was designed to sort of deal with discrimination in housing rather than in the sort of, so extend the principles of the 1964 Act to principles of housing.
Well, you know, since we started with housing, and now I think we've pretty much discussed the Green Book, let's go back to housing, because the Fair Housing Act of 1968 is something I don't know a great deal about. So why don't you enlighten me, if you would, please?
Yeah, no, thanks. It basically says that it prohibits advertising that indicates any preference for race. So you can't say, furnished apartment for rent in private white home or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that applies to the, you just can't have these sorts of distinctions based on race. And actually, it's been expanded somewhat also. And then it prohibits discrimination in the sale or rental or provision of housing services on the basis of race or familial status or disability. It's broader, and it's been sort of expanded over time. There were some major additions to it in 1988. There's an exception if you have a very small number of units. So I think if it's you have four or fewer units, you can't advertise the discrimination, but you can refuse to rent based on race. You just can't tell people.
Yeah, let's pause. That might not seem apparent, the reason for that, for some people. But of course, if you think about it for a moment, it is. It's one thing for some person to own an apartment complex and to discriminate. That's essentially a commercial transaction.
Right.
But if it's Ma Smith who owns a big house and is renting out rooms,
it's just a couple of rooms.
Right.
Federal government says, hey, we don't want to get involved.
They don't want to get involved in it. And again, I am not in any way, shape, or form defending racial discrimination, but it's the very idea that the government would tell Ma Smith in any way, shape, or form whom she could rent to in her own home that I think accounts for that exception.
In Congress, they called it the Mrs. Murphy exception. But then you had the other folks come back and say, well, the problem is there are lots of Mrs. Murphys in this country, and there are not a lot of, you know, Exxons or Shell Oil or whoever the big companies that might be. It's not Exxon, but it'd be some other company that might want to discriminate. So it was a delicate accommodation that was made, and this relates largely to housing in order to, I think, make the act more acceptable to voters and people in Congress. It's a really, and I think it goes to this distinction between sort of private action and sort of commercial action.
Right.
I think that's the sort of the moment where you're like, this is like Shelley v. Kramer, right? The 1948 great Supreme Court case, striking down restrictive covenants. They said, hey, if you're making basically all of the desirable housing stock in all of the major cities unavailable, that's not right. Mm-hmm. And that looks like the government's involved in it. And if there's something that's going on not readily apparent by one person, that's something the government can't adequately police, even if it wanted to. And I think that accounts for these sorts of distinctions.
But well, I'm going to ask you a question. I think I already know the answer to it, but did the Fair Housing Act, did it solve the problem?
I mean, it's done a lot to reduce overt discrimination. I think probably maybe the best part of it is Section C that relates to striking down racial advertising so that we don't have to deal with any of that. I think that's really positive. It's hard to win a Fair Housing Act claim.
I was about to say, did it just drive it underground? I mean, I've read the occasional article in the newspapers or on the web where they'll talk about investigators going out and getting disparate treatment depending on whether they show up and they have white skin or black skin.
Sure. These sort of testers I think it's hard to get a good numbers on this, but I think it hasn't obviously taken care of all housing inequality, but it's outlawed overt discrimination. In pretty much all transactions other than these ones we were talking about earlier, very, very small amount of housing stock. I think one of its important effects is it strikes down redlining. So this is, in provision of housing or financial products related to housing. I think it's a really positive step in the right direction, and it's unclear to me how much further we could go with a statute that would be acceptable to Congress.
Understood.
I think it was a fairly decent accommodation, particularly for the times.
Understood. Okay. Well, we're getting short on time, and I'm just guessing. Let's go back to the Green Book briefly. I'm guessing that after the Civil Rights Act of 1964, certainly after the Fair Housing Act of 1968, that the need for and ultimately the existence of the Green Book had passed.
Yeah, in some ways it's a great story, right? That no longer, I think the last edition is like 65. Mm-hmm. So it's right after the Fair Housing Act, right after the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and I mean that's a positive, right? That we don't need that book because African Americans can stay and eat wherever they want. I mean that's the great part of this story. There is a talk about how the end of Jim Crow injured some African American institutions, historically black schools, for instance.
Yeah, isn't that an irony? Yeah, there are institutions that grew up under Jim Crow, and after it was over, those institutions have been harmed.
Something's lost, but it's such a wonderful development that our citizens can stay wherever they want, and eat wherever they want and use whatever filling station they want to.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Alfred Brophy of the University of North Carolina Law School in Chapel Hill. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineers are Chad Barrett and Bob Hoffman. Our music is by the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. Our Madison Minute is done by the absolutely wonderful, tremendous, and in all ways good Jim Blaylock. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.